everybody, and welcome to the second episode of Mooney's Mini Bites. I'm your host, Kosi, and I'm joined always by Wani B. And, dude, we just could not leave the biggest show on Earth alone, because we're going to run it back again with the Severance Mooney's Mini Bites.
No, absolutely.
Wani, is that correct?
Absolutely, Kosi. Listen, this is biggest show on television. In my opinion, the best show on television. And I really feel like we have to do it justice by giving a quick review of each week's episode. So without further ado, again, Mooney's Mini Bites format, quick, just jump into the episode. No thrills, no frills. So let's get started, Kosi.
Yeah, man.
All right, so going over first a recap of last week's episode. It was called Who is Alive? Episode 3 of Severance Season 2. Now, who...
Biggest question going right now.
it actually goes into specifically why that's an important question.
Yeah.
We actually opened the episode kind of strangely, where Audi Mark is kind of sprinting to Lumen, kind of rushing to get to the door, looking at his watch closely, seems to be timing something. Right.
He's trying to keep track of something. I've noticed, you know, upon like my rewatches, his watches change. I don't know if you realize. Well, it's very clear, but like it's a different kind of like, because he had an analog watch,
yes,
whatever it was, and like that like really simple one, and like now it's like, you know, kind of showing the progression of where he's at. But no, it's a different kind of thing he's got on his wrist now.
Yes, actually, they have their watches on the outside. And then when they go to their lockers to go downstairs, they switch to a specific watch, I guess, approved by Lumen, right? So they don't, I'm guessing so they don't take, you know, like messages in their watch or something along those lines, right?
That makes so much sense, actually. Yeah, it's like a way to just keep control over it. Yeah, right. Keep control over
it. But them. Actually, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Kosi, because it does actually a common motif in the show. We see a ton of clocks, watches. There's a clock over the security guard, a digital guard that's often very visibly portrayed. There's the watches on the hands. There's the clocks, both when they come out of the elevator, there's an immediate watch, or I mean clock, you know, clock on the wall. Same in their office.
Yeah.
We keep seeing it a lot. There's been a few times where they've played with things, kind of played with the sensation of time. It seems like, you know, they want you to focus, you know, on the specifically that, okay, they showed up at 9:02, they showed up at 9:05. They keep bringing up one of those things that could easily be used to pull off a twist, you know, like some lost time, something that's hard to notice, but you notice if you see on the watch. Interesting right. Visual and idea that the show keeps playing with and getting us to focus on. So anyways,
yeah, just to piggyback off of, I think to piggyback off what you said, like it does have a kind of obsession with time, not just like you know, just in terms of the motifs, but then, you know, the whole idea of the show, like, or just the one mechanic of the show where you kind of lose that track of time, you're not sure when you go from Indy to Audi, what's happening between them. So again, I think the show wants me as a viewer to be cognizant of like time. What time is it? Where are we at? I think, you know, it even goes into when they ask the innies or natties, like the questioning, like, hey, like what state are you in? Like what date is it? Like this whole obsession with time and like prolonging it even, which again, they're like kind of firing that at you is what I definitely caught on to early on with this.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, it's definitely something they want you to focus on. Anyways, moving through the plot, at this point, Mark goes down, gets to work, right? We don't really know why he kind of rushed in, but now we're back to Innie Mark, right, at the Sever floor. So Innie Mark, his goal still is to try to find out what happened to his Audi's wife, right? He obviously only briefly knows her as Miss Casey. Still considers her a friend and one of the innies, right? Would want to rescue her for that reason alone, but does not have obviously the love and attachment Audi Mark has for his wife.
Right. I think he's like making like a like some wanted signs, whatever. Like she's missing.
Yes,
whatever, like,
yes, exactly. Awareness. He puts Prince Little posters, basically. Prince Little posters with her face on it, and basically asks his buddies there to go help him. Right, spread it around. He asked Bert to go to the O&D office back where his friends were. Not Bert, sorry, Irv. To go where where Christopher Walken used to work with all the other with all his other O&D optics and design, I think it's called O&D friends.
Yeah.
So Irving goes and he's kind of nervous about going there, but he decides to go anyway. Basically, he's still kind of traumatized about Bert leaving. He hasn't been back since there, obviously, in his mind.
Hey, Juan, I have a question.
Yes.
So like so Mark's making all these wanted signs and obviously bringing like kind of a definitely will attract attention from the people up top. Isn't this like not a like a smart play? Like should he conduct this investigation of what happened to her like on the low? Like I kind of found that kind of weird. Like why is he like
just you know that's actually crazy, just an interesting part of the show. They supposedly told them, and they kind of briefly mention it. They supposedly told them there's no longer cameras or microphones. They don't have barriers on the doors or everything. Nobody seems to be watching. So, I mean, they're just brazen, right? They're sitting there trying to play somewhat nice, maybe somewhat getting to work. But they're a lot more brazen than they were before. And I think Lumen is still trying to figure out how to get a handle and get Mark in particular to work. Right?
Okay.
So at this point, you know, they spread out the posters and Irving finally decides to go to optics and design. There he meets, I think her name is Felicia in the show, older black lady. Not sure what her actress's name is. But they basically reminisce.
Oh, she's great, man.
Yeah, they basically reminisce about Bert, right? The times they shared together. One other thing I didn't mention is that at this point, if we recalled in the season one, Irving, he had seen that his Audi had painting a bunch of paintings with, you know, basically a dark black corridor leading to a elevator with a little red arrow.
Yeah, the elevator.
Yeah, the elevator. That's actually a great phrase for it. Yeah, it is, I think, meant to symbolize hell. If the suburb,
that's definitely what I thought.
If the regular suburb floor is meant to kind of symbolize purgatory, then that floor seems to be kind of, you know, the lower base, you know, the lower levels of hell, so to speak. It's definitely that's kind of what it seems to imply. Go ahead.
In terms of lower levels, then, do you think, do you think that there are other floors in Lumen?
No, I mean,
that like we haven't seen.
There's obviously the
elevator. Way, I guess
there's obviously the regular floors where the normal employees work, right? But we haven't seen anything about those, and I don't think they're too interesting. Just regular corporate offices. The more interesting thing, we have seen Miss Casey towards the end of season one get sent down this exact corridor that Irving pictures and you know just draws over and over. Audi Irving, basically. They call it, I think, the training floor.
Training floor, yes.
Yeah, something like that in season one. And they're trying to find out that's where they think maybe Miss Casey is. We know, the audience knows that is where Miss Casey is. But they, you know, potentially think that's where she might be. So Irving had kind of drawn a sketch to show his any co-workers. And he takes that sketchbook with him because he had also drawn sketches of Bert. You know, obviously, he's really in love with Bert. He misses Bert. He's really good at sketching, too. So he does these really pretty sketches of Bert. And he shows Felicia. I can't remember if it was Felicia or Alicia, but the black lady that was friends with Bert. So, you know, they're reminiscing and stuff. And she starts flipping through. And it turns out she recognizes that hall. She recognizes that dark hall. She calls it the exports hall. And she says they used
to, that was very interesting. Yeah,
she says they used to take their, I guess we saw in season one, they made little knickknacks or little flashcards or obviously drawings and stuff. We're not really sure what it's all for, right? But we
still, Lumen makes like a lot of stuff. They have their hands in a lot of things and like have to get it exported, I guess, like down below.
Right. And we're still not really sure. I think I saw at one point they saw but look like watering cans, or like cards that look like you would see in a self-defense corporate class. Just weird little things that don't make too much sense independently. But now we know they're apparently going down there, right? We obviously care about what this exports hall is, and it's been a mysterious thing that's been brought up a couple of times now. So it's clearly implied she knows where it is and that now she can take Irving, right? And then, you know, it kind of cuts out from that. And at that point, we don't really see Irving for the rest of the episode. And we go to Mark and Helly, you know, basically taking a stroll down the hall. They're trying to find the goat people, actually, they found in season one, the goat department. They don't really know anything. They don't really know anything about it. They just saw some guy giving some goats little milk out of a bottle. Anyways, they go back there. They manage to find it, and they go through the little corridor, little goat poop on the side and stuff. And they,
I gotta add though, that whole sequence was like straight up out of like Alice in Wonderland or Willy Wonka, where like they have to like go down a like that they open like a little door. It's small, and they have to like kind of like go in and get smaller.
I also heard
just
the
visuals and all.
Being John Malkovich.
Being John Malkovich, yeah, and then it just like plays to the fact that hey, like you're not in like the regular reality, and like you know you want to see how deep the rabbit hole goes, or in this case how deep the corridor the goats go down. So yeah, it's a really really cool visual that they did with
absolutely that. And then we come upon one of the more striking scenes down on the severed floor. Everything so far has been, you know, very much Apple store, yeah, to the extreme
white
white, a few off, you know, very technological, futuristic.
Or cool blue. Yeah.
This is a big meadow, like a big grassy meadow with a bunch of goats. And
looks like real grass they put in there too. It's kind of cool.
Real grass, otherwise, how would the goats be eating it, right?
I don't know how it gets watered though. Like, there's no like watering system. They like replace the grass.
Sprinklers or something. Yeah. I mean, if they can figure that out, I mean, you know, they have got goats growing down there. Obviously, the goats need to eat something. At this point, it's a very unsettling scene too, because we see some of the goats. Are actually people in goat
costumes.
Yeah,
one guy's in a goat costume. Yeah. Some scary movie stuff right
there.
So
they go on, and then we see Brienne of Tarth, Gwendolyn Christie.
Yeah. Where's the big woman?
Yeah, the big woman. I think her name is Lorne in the show. Don't quote me on that, though.
Yeah, Lorne.
Lorne, there we go. So Lorne. So they basically say, hey, we're looking for Miss Casey. We're here. And it turns out there's a department called Mammalian Nurturing, I believe they called it. New department, they just, you know,
this where it got interesting.
They raise goats, and then they keep kind of asking, like, hey, no, we like she kind of gives a wave with her eyes that she knows who Miss Casey is, even though she says she doesn't. And then so they keep insisting, and at that point, she gets mad and starts ringing her bell. And then it's like something out of a Stephen King movie, right? Like in a Stephen King novel, like the goat people all come out of the hills. It looks very cool.
Yeah.
Like exactly the kind of bad, you know, it's scary. We haven't really seen too much horror in this show so far, but there's a very unsettling scene, right? Even though they're supposedly all co-workers and it looks like a nice meadow before, the mood changes very quickly. At that point, Helly, you know, kind of takes charge and shows everyone, hey, look, we're just looking for Miss Casey. We just care about her too. They kind of convince them that she's like one of the goats that they've lost, and they're just trying to take care of their people like they take care of their goats, and that seems to soften them a bit. And then, you know, they... Yeah, go ahead.
No, she was... Yeah, I was just saying, the waitress was able just to, like, defuse the situation. I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to get too ahead, but, like, definitely had me, like, side-eyeing Ellie, because, I don't know, just... Because, you know, the whole show is based upon, like, you know, who's in, who's an outie, like, what's going on, what's this. We definitely have, like, a whole thing going on with Helly.
We'll discuss that in a second, because we could get into a whole mess with that. But anyways, so yeah, at that point, they kind of tell her Miss Casey's come a few times. Mark and Helly kind of have a will they or won't they moment in the corridor when they're laughing and stuff and kind of freaking out, where they look like they might kiss. But, you know, they don't. A little bit awkward.
It was a cool shot where, like, even before he did that, remember when, like, he kind of stopped and, like, the camera was kind of, like, I don't know, how do I put it? Like, it was kind of like almost in the third person. And, again, like, I remember, like, was that season one, like though that some guy was like creeping on him. Mm-hmm. And like I like it kind of sort of like reminded me, I don't know if it was just to say that the guy was there, but like it definitely like the camera choices show like, hey, like Mark's gonna be always like nervous and looking over his shoulder, like literally and like, kind of also figuratively, in these like tender moments he has.
Yeah, no, definitely really they're used to being watched. They're used to not having true privacy in any ways. Okay. Yeah. So anyways, you know, we finish with Mark and Helly at this point. Now we get one of the more interesting scenes of the season. Dylan had refused to go and refused to help search for Miss Casey. He kept saying he needed to get to work. And it's because, if we remember from episode one, basically Mr. Milkshake promised him that he'd get, to see his family. He'd get a little room to see his family. And it's that's what happens. He goes and he gets to meet his wife. There's a brief moment where, I mean, at least I was, and I think most viewers were obviously cautious, like, oh, is this actually his wife? Do we know? It's notable that they don't show his kid, who he's the only one he's seen, so it could be just a different Lumen employee pretending. But it fairly quickly becomes obvious that it is his wife. They have some, like, tender, funny moments. Turns out Dylan's Audi is kind of a loser, that's why he's working at Lumen. He couldn't really find any other jobs. And she still, his wife still seems to love him, but she still also seems to be slightly disappointed. Maybe potentially setting up a scenario later where she's like, because Dylan's more confident, more brash, a little childlike and innocent, but he's successful at his job. You know, it's a clear difference, right? It almost feels like, okay, maybe this is like a fresher Dylan before the burdens of, you know, living and children and the stresses of all that wore him down. Maybe it's a more focused and centered Dylan. We don't quite know, but it at least sets up the possibility that it'll be, you know, a will they or won't they between him and Dylan's Audi and Dylan's Indy for his wife. And it sets up a situation where now Dylan doesn't want to rock the boat, or any Dylan, doesn't want to rock the boat, doesn't want to mess around, doesn't want to piss off Lumen, because now he's seeing his wife. Now he's seeing his family. And he knows if he behaves, he'll keep getting these visitations and, you know, setting up basically a scenario where he can betray the rest of his coworkers who he's known his whole life, right? For the possibility of seeing his kids, his wife. And I mean, you kind of understand it, right? He's never really experienced anything like that. He got hugged. He feels special. He feels loved for the first time in his life. They're setting up, obviously, they're trying to divide and conquer, right? Trying to give them different reasons to turn on each other instead of openly controlling them like they did in season one. Trying different manipulation tactics, basically, the Lumen board. Now, at this point, we get to... I'm glad you watched this episode, Cozy, because I would love to hear some of your takes on this scene. The scene where Mr. Milkshake gets his present for his promotion with the paintings. So we're walking into the scene, and again, I really love to hear your takes on this, where Mr. Milkshake gets rewarded for his promotion by being given pictures by the board of basically Kier, the original Kier, just race swapped.
Yep.
Race swap. So Cozy, looks like him, take it away, man, because definitely got to get a black man's perspective on this.
Well, it's funny you said that, because the first thing I thought was, oh, it feels as though they're trying to get with the times and update their look. Reminded me a lot about how companies would try to just almost, you know, this whole DEI whole thing in our government has become like a whole like lightning rod of people's different opinions. So it definitely felt like this company's trying to take that route. But I see it also as that they definitely see promise in Mr. Milkshake. He's someone that they definitely think is like could be a huge asset. But I also like the fact that he knows this, that what he's aware of what he can do, but he's also very cognizant of that this looks weird. So like I would have also thought like, all right, this is cool. I like how you guys think of me in this way, but or that I can rise in this way, but this is done in a really, it seemed pretty performative almost and kind of weird. Hence why I liked how later on he took that same picture and put it up in a and like somewhere else to in a way to be to, in a way to be to say, hey, I'll accept this, but I'm keeping an eye on this. And it definitely reflects just, you know, my life and just other minority people's lives where we kind of accept these almost like, I wouldn't call what they did a microaggression, but it almost seems as though they're pandering or trying to like make it seem as though, oh, you know, you're a good one, you can join our ranks and like, look, you can be here too. So there was definite weird vibes to it, and definitely a painting that's done in your likeness is a bit weird. But yeah, it was definitely jarring, say the least, in that regard.
No, it definitely reminded me, not great take, by the way, because I really appreciated hearing that. Yeah. But definitely reminded me, you know, of when companies are like, oh, hey, we're going to be, especially movies, right? Oh, we're going to be diverse. Oh, hey, we're going to race swap someone in 17th century England to be a black man, but, you know, like a regular homeowner. You know what I mean? Or, yeah. Or like Black Little Mermaid, or, you know, just these moves that are like, hey, look how woke and how, you know, diverse we are and how much we support black people.
See, you can be but here then, too. You know, look, yeah.
Yeah, but they don't actually, you know, do anything, right? Like, you don't, you know, it's not like they suddenly put a black person in charge of Disney. It's not like we're suddenly getting more movies in this vein. It's just like, oh, hey, here's this little token of, you know,
it's much of
appreciation, I guess.
Yeah, it's much easier to paint a picture like that. Like, that was easier for Lumen and them to all do. Instead of, you know, making actual change that'll be effective for them and for Mr. Milkshake. It seemed very performative.
Yeah, and then one last thing, I just want to highlight the acting between him and Natalie, because Natalie also black, and she also got.
I also have some thoughts on her too.
Paintings.
Yeah.
Now go ahead, take it away, Cozy.
Yeah, that entire scene, it definitely reminded me of Get Out and Lumen. You know, we're not sure what Lumen's doing. There are a lot of theories, but like, it definitely felt in that whole scene. There was a scene in the first Get Out where Daniel Kaluuya, he's sitting with the maid, who, you know, this is a 8-year-old movie, and it's revealed the maid has her head, she inside of her is the brain of the matriarch of the family, and she's being piloted. So she was able to kind of to break out for a second. There was one instance where between her and Milkshake, an amazing scene, by the way, where he's off in one part of the room, and the camera follows her, and the actress it's an incredible job. She's locked in on Milkshake, just eyes, she doesn't even blink, and she looks, and then I forgot what question he asked, but her reaction where she said congratulations or congratulating him, and just the smile, and it felt like it felt almost painful, and it definitely felt as though she's like, oh no, I see another one. I see like someone that could possibly be captured and put into this horrible machine that I'm part of that I can't get out of. It definitely felt as I definitely got vibes of that scene in particular. And again, just props to the actress in that scene. Props to both of them, but for
absolutely
haunting performance.
And again, since this is always first and foremost a show about corporate culture, corporate parody, just, you know, the fact that, yeah, black people can climb to a certain level, or minorities can climb to a certain level, but they don't get to really be in charge. You know, they don't really get the true power. They still have to, you know, they might get paid well, they might get sat at a nice desk, but they don't get the full authority and the full respect their other peers get.
There's still a black person in that position at the end of the day. That's what it is. Like, okay, you can rise up, but you're still... Just know where you can go, or know how high you can get it, sort of, in a sense.
Right. Okay, so to keep this going a little bit, at this point we see Miss Cobell. She had refused the offer from the board, basically for the new employment. Seemed like she was leaving town, like she was packing up and leaving. Right before she leaves, she kind of looks down and looks at the breathing tube she had taken at the end of season one. At this point, it seems clear that it's a breathing tube for her mother. Or at least a very close relative.
Yes, it was her mother.
Born in 1944. Yeah, it seems to be her mother. I don't think they've been confirmed. But right. Yeah, it seems to be what's heavily implied. And so between that and her interest in Mark and Miss Casey's relationship, it seems at least somewhat clear to me that there's some part of her that believes Lumen's work can maybe bring her mom back.
Definitely, she thinks she
cares about.
She definitely wants to use like that.
It seems like that's the implication.
Yeah.
Anyway, so she goes back, talks to Elena. They have a conversation. And right before she's about to go in the building, she kind of looks at the driver or the security guard funny. And then just
peels off. I think she knew him or seen him before. Definitely felt like in that scene where like in movies where they're the main character says, "Oh, they're behind me, aren't they?" Or in that kind of way. It's kind of almost comedic.
It did feel like that. And then she peels off because she acts so Patricia Arquette does such a great job with Miss Cordell. Oh, yeah. Just an unhinged performance the whole time, very cultishly devoted, but also just very crazy and over the top. Love her performance in this show.
Oh, yeah.
We don't really get a clear idea of what it was. You might have just got a bad feeling, like, you know, when you're about to get popped in a gangster movie and you decide to just take off.
It's that scene in Goodfellas. That's literally what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's a great example. So at this point, we get to the biggest scene of, frankly, not just this episode, but the whole season, maybe the whole show. It turns out the title of the episode and what Mark was doing at the beginning of the episode, this is a stupid idea, by the way. He was trying to burn into his retinas the message, "Who is alive?" Right? That's the title of the episode. Basically looking at a UV light to burn the message into his retinas. If you've ever just looked at something in a really bright light, you know, you can kind of burn it into your eyes for a second. You blink a while and you still see
blotches.
You see the blotches. But doing that with a UV light for enough time to be able to, I think he timed it where it was like 2 minutes to get to the door. I can't stress enough. He was going to go blind if he kept working on that. He was absolutely going to blind himself. At that point, before he finishes doing that, Rigabi comes out. The person who reintegrated Petey, who killed the security guard in season one.
Man, she scared me when he was in the car and she just showed up. That was
scared the shit out of me too.
That was really good. That was a really good jump scare.
Very, very mysterious figure. We know nothing about her basically so far, other than she's heavily involved in the severance procedure, actually put Mark's chip inside him. Anyways, at that point she offers to reintegrate him if he really wants to find out. And she confirms for him that as far as she knows, his wife is alive, which to us, we have already, it's already been established several times, right. So it's not as big a reveal.
But now he knows,
that's massive. He already has his suspicions, frankly, because of his sister, because of the innie shouting, "She's alive."
Mm-hmm.
But now he gets full confirmation and he says immediately, "Yes, I want to see my wife. I want to do this. Go." Now, again, this I honestly feel is one of the, this is a breathtaking bit of television. Right, cinematography wise, the music, the way the way it plays out, the suspense that builds up, the way Mark's reintegration scene. Right, we go in. It's one of those things that you have to see. It's almost impossible to describe.
It's there was I think in there there was a definite shot where like when it was happening, I'm not sure if they built this, but they built a whole desk where he's on and they'll film him in one room and then film it again in the other room, but have it switch back and forth in between and seamlessly in a way to kind of almost like disorient you, but kind of give you the feeling of coming back and going back and forth in between like two people, which is essentially what was happening. You know, just again, brilliant way they did that.
Brilliant work by everyone involved. Just the way the music starts playing up, the way we start seeing scenes from what we know has to be Mark's first moment of life, which calls back the first moment of the first season, right? The opening of season one. So the opening of the whole show, obviously. So call back to that. We see him, you know, flipping back and forth between the desk where he's at and the desk down the Lumen floor. his clothes flip back and forth, the everything. We see the brain waves start to mash together in certain shapes, some of which we've seen similar to the stuff we've seen before. Just breathtaking work. The music starts exploding, and the last thing we see is Petey asking, "Who are you?" Which is, of course, one of the most topical major questions thematically of the entire show. And that's where we end. And it's, I can't stress enough, that's one of the, my favorite scenes of the year. I mean, year's short, right? One of my favorite scenes of the past 2 years.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Like that, one of my favorite TV scenes I think I've ever seen. It's just breathtaking how well it's put together, how well it shows that transition, how well it takes you into the chaos that must be putting two minds together that really don't entirely match up. They don't chronographically match up. He's not trying to get the memories for stuff that happened technically years ago. It's a mess. And, you know, that's where the episode ends.